Welcome to The Breakaway, a Sacramento Republic podcast.
Bandit in the box! Unbelievable strike!
My goodness, what a defensive play!
Half the crowd can't even believe it!
Welcome into The Breakaway. Thank you guys for joining us. I'm your host, Connor Sutton. And on today's podcast, we have round two, episode two of our Pride podcast here in Pride Month. And we talked to three gentlemen from Stonewall FC, one of the most famous LGBT plus soccer teams around the world. We talked to three gentlemen, the first team captain Jay Lemonius, manager Eric Najib, and co-founder Asley Pitter, and they talk about some of their struggles and what they have found since coming to Stonewall FC and a little bit of the creation. Oh, and oh, by the way, pretty excited about this. I might have gotten invited to a Man United match. Pretty excited about that. Overall, great interview with these three gentlemen. And a really, really cool interview. I hope you guys enjoy it. So let's get right to it. Well, we have the gentleman from Stonewall FC on the podcast today. And guys, if you wouldn't, please introduce yourself. What is your current role with Stonewall FC? And talk to me a little bit about your history of football.
Asley?
Okay, I'll go first. My name is Asley Pitter. Was with the club when the club started back in 1991. My current role is a third team right back. Not as quick as I used to be, but I'm still hanging in there. You want to know about how a club started, maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. A group of guys decided they were at a meeting, a GFSN meeting, which is a Gay Football Supporters Network meeting. And they had the brilliant idea of actually just getting together a group of gay guys to go and play football in a park, because up to that time, a few of us had been playing in regular football, soccer teams, and not being able to be ourselves. We couldn't talk about boyfriends and guys that we fancied, things like that. So they thought it'd be really refreshing just for a group of us to meet up and play. Several people turned up. Seven to start with, then it grew from then, and an ad went in the local gay press, which drew more and more people to the club. And what happened from that is that we had so many people join that they thought it'd be a great idea to actually join a league. And because there were no other gay football teams there around at the time, we were the only, we could only join a straight league. And I don't think the idea was to maybe sort of like be pioneers as such. It was basically because we wanted to be ourselves amongst ourselves. But what happened is that because we had to join straight leagues, we then became very, very visible. So the fact that we were gay and being gay in our regular straight teams, we could hide that fact. We couldn't actually hide the fact once we joined a league, because, joining a league, you had to go to a meeting. You had to declare who you were, basically. And that came out at one of the league meetings just to join. And from then on, we were out amongst straight teams. A very, very difficult time, because you can imagine we were losing people left, right, and center from the AIDS epidemic. There were certain pieces of legislation in England at the time that restricted the promotion of homosexuality as a alternative lifestyle. It's called Section 28, brought in by the Conservative government. And we had all these things about, we had negative press from tabloid newspapers. Anything bad that happened, you could bet your bottom dollar or pound that, gay men were responsible. So with that climate, we were born. And as it went on, we just changed inadvertently the perception of gay men and sport, football in particular, because the attitude was gay men didn't play football. They did ice skating, they did badminton, they did swimming and diving. That's all they did. But then the rough and tumble sports, they wouldn't be involved in. And we actually proved that, yeah, we are football fans and we like playing as well. And we'll play just as tough as anybody else. So like I said, that backdrop back in 1991 going on, it was difficult, but we were slowly, inadvertently just changing perception about gay men in football.
Eric, you want to jump in from there?
Yeah, I think obviously what you've got also, the advantage is you've got three different generations of Stonewall footballer. Astley obviously was there from the beginning, and I think Astley is being a little bit modest. I mean, Astley was one of the key founding members of the club back in 1991. And all the stuff that that group of guys went through paved the way for the people in my era to be able to play the league football that we played for Stonewall Football Club. I joined the club in 2001 and then was asked to be manager, or in US terms, coach, in 2006, and have been the coach ever since 2006. And obviously, even in the time that I've been at the club, which is quite a long time, not quite as long as Astley, you can see sympathies changing and perceptions changing. But none of it would have been possible without what the guys before me had to go through. And we had some hard times as well. We played against some teams that were pretty obvious to us. They weren't comfortable playing with us, or being in the same facility as us, or maybe they thought they were going to catch something. But I think Astley makes a good point. When you join a league, you then have to play a team twice a season. And if you're in the same league year after year, which we are, you then you're seeing the same people. And it sort of normalizes it, because when you bump into someone, you know, twice, then four times, then six times, and eight times, by the sixth time, you're sort of saying, hi, how are you? So it becomes a lot more difficult to have that prejudice. I think it's also important to say, as important it was from the UK's point of view with Stonewall, let's not forget that prior to Stonewall, you know, two or three American teams had already, you know, San Francisco Spikes, I think, and the LA Suns, maybe, I think, are probably the two oldest LGBT teams in the world. And that was as early as 1980, 1981, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a full 10 years before we came on the scene. But yeah, it's just been an absolute whirlwind for us, culminating in, as you said, Connor, with the you know, the fantastic occasion we had at Wembley Stadium, which, you know, Jay was lucky enough to play in and captain the team that day. Very lucky. Astley, at least I managed to organise that you and me were on the side of the pitch.
Yeah, I was happy with that.
So was I. So I'll segue now onto Jay, obviously.
Yeah, so hi guys, I'm Jay, and sort of as Eric mentioned, I'm a first team player, and I've had the privilege of being captain over the last couple of years, or couple of seasons. And there's not too much to add on to kind of what sort of Ashley and Ass and Eric have sort of touched upon. But from my perspective, when I joined the club, I joined from another LGBT team that are also based in London. So I'd already been playing sort of LGBT inclusive football. And for me, I don't think I've ever told this story with Eric around before, actually. But I remember the only reason why I kind of came into contact with the club, because I think I scored like five or ten goals in two games against the third team. And I think Eric I had a couple of friends who played for the club, and I ended up coming along to an inter-club friendly. And I spoke to Eric, and Eric was like, it'd be great to kind of have you along. If you want to play with high standard, we'd love to have you along on a Saturday. And at the time, I think it was the wrong pitch for me, because I'd sort of played at a high standard as a kid. And I wasn't necessarily motivated by playing at a high standard. But what kind of sold it for me was kind of meeting Ass. And obviously, I had a relationship with Ass before, and meeting other members of the club, and falling in love with the history of the club, and finding out how long Eric had been manager. And it was the history of the club that I fell in love with, and the people that make the club run on a weekly basis is kind of the heart and soul of it. So yeah, for me it was an amazing opportunity to join the club and be a part of that history, and to have people like Ass and Eric around who've been there, done that, and been around for so many years and a part of the fabric of the club is inspiring on a weekly basis to kind of be able to kind of create that history ourselves.
Jay, Connor.
No, go ahead.
When you scored those five goals, I got a call.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I got a call because, just to give you guys a bit of context, so our first team plays in the Middlesex County Premier League, which is, you know, probably just before semi-professional standard. And then our second and third team plays in slightly more, you know, slightly less high up leagues. So our third team plays against a lot of the other LGBT teams from London. So if, for example, there are some players within those teams that perhaps could play at that higher standard without taking them fully away from their friends, because you can play a Saturday and a Sunday, I've always got a couple of spies there. And I got a phone call from Alexis, another old Stonewall player who's still part of the club, who said, Eric, you've got to come down and see this guy called Jay. So that's how I ended up with that initial conversation.
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, when I heard that you got the phone call, we're playing for the first team, my initial thought was, brilliant, now he can stop terrorizing the third team.
Unfortunately, that didn't happen, because
he still played, you know. Then you couldn't do a bad tackle on him because he had to play for the first team. So yeah.
Although I did try last year.
Before Stonewall FC, I guess, Asley, I can ask you this, is what did you feel like the state of being a gay footballer was, and what were you trying to solve for?
I never really gave it much thought. I was quite happy staying in the closet, basically, just playing football. I mean, I started playing when I was 10 years old, and I think I knew there was something different about me from the age of 8. I knew then. But then I just thought, you know what, I can spend the rest of my life foolishly thinking that I could actually not be myself. So I was happy just playing in straight teams and just hiding the fact that I was gay, until that moment when I heard about, you know, these guys who wanted to play in the park. And even then, it was exciting and I wanted to be involved, but I was absolutely petrified. I was so scared to actually do it. One, because of my own perceptions about gay men playing, you know, sport, what would it be like in a changing room? I had all those as well. Am I going to, you know, I had all the fear going on. But I think once I got involved and thought, hey, this looks really good, I like these guys, they seem to be serious about the football, I thought, yeah, I could get involved here. But the real turning point for me was, I think 3 years, 94, the Gay Games was in New York. And that was my first full tournament with the club. And just going to the opening ceremony at the Columbus University Stadium, where fanfares and the amount of other sports teams and clubs, badminton, cricket, tennis, golf, bodybuilding, swimming, all these people all descended on New York City. And for me, if I had to say there was a turning point, that was the turning point. I knew once that happened, I could not actually leave the club and go anywhere else. I just felt we had family all over the world and they all just turned up in one place. So going back to your question, I didn't, you know, I was very happy just sort of like just hiding the fact that I was gay and thinking I could just bluff my way through it. But then that all changed once getting involved with Stonewall and then going to New York Gay Games.
Very, very, very interesting. I think interesting that you weren't really trying to solve for a problem and then it just kind of happened. That's pretty interesting. I guess if I had a guess, I wouldn't have thought that that's how it would have started. And Jay, I want to ask you, obviously, Stonewall FC had a chance to play at Wembley Stadium. We talked about it a little bit earlier. And you guys were the first LGBT club to play at Wembley, but also the first non-league team to play a competitive match there. Can you guys tell us about that experience and what it was like?
Yeah, it was absolutely magical experience. I think I speak for everybody in the club when I say it's one of those most surreal moments. I'm a West Ham fan. So if anybody asked me, is it a dream to play at Wembley? I'd be like, no, that's not even on the radar. I'd say probably Upton Park, that would be the dream. That would probably be the most realistic dream anyway. But yeah, to have the opportunity to play at Wembley was an incredible experience, very surreal. And I think it was just an incredible experience, not just for the 11 players that they got to play, or the squad, the sort of 20-man squad, they got to play on the day. But it was a celebration of the club's history and all the people that got us to that moment. Because we wouldn't have had that opportunity if it wasn't for people like Ash, people like Eric, people like Doug, who had been part of the club for years, and kind of built this club up to be in the positions and to have the privilege of doing that. So it was just an incredible celebration for the cause, for the club. And it was also amazing to get the 3 points in the league as well. So I don't know if I'd be this happy and this reminiscent about it if we'd have lost the game, but that definitely makes it even more sweeter for sure.
And then, Jay, can you tell us a little bit about your work with Stonewall, the nonprofit, and the Rainbow Laces campaign?
Yeah, so Stonewall UK are the biggest LGBT charity in Europe. And I worked there for about 2 to 3 years. A big part of my role was managing Rainbow Laces campaign, but another part of my role was working across all the sports partnerships we have, specifically within football. So managing Rainbow Laces was another great opportunity to kind of combine my passion for football, but also the elements of my identity, which probably haven't always been comfortable of being LGBT. I've been lucky enough that football's kind of given me a platform, it's given me a given me great sort of experiences in life, and it's not the same for a lot of LGBT people. So that role kind of really allows me to kind of work on creating a more inclusive environment for LGBT people in sport as a whole, and also trying to empower and inspire people to, through campaigning measures, to be able to kind of be the change that they want to see in the environments, and also work with people in power, because ultimately you need allies, you need people, and huge organizations with massive resources to be able to be invested in this agenda. So it was a great opportunity, and yeah, Rainbow Laces is an incredible campaign. I think over the last 3 years, it's definitely shifted the dial onto kind of the mainstream. It was through the Rainbow Laces campaign that we got the opportunity at Wembley, and there's definitely been a massive step change, particularly over the last 3 years, of how the wider discourse outside of LGBT football are talking about LGBT inclusion. So it's definitely a massive reinvestment in understanding the issues at hand. And I think sports is in a far better place in being able to kind of deal with that now than it was, say, 4 or 5 years ago.
And hopefully 4 or 5 years from now, it'll be even easier to talk about and more common in the world. Jay, can you tell us a little bit about your current job with the FA and how that came about?
Yeah, so I was, through my last role at Stonewall, as well as managing Rainbow Laces, I worked across predominantly our football partnerships. So we had a 3-year strategic partnership with the Premier League, groundbreaking partnerships where we're looking at community programs and how we embed LGBT inclusive content into them, working with clubs around their player care staff and how they support players who might be gay, bi, questioning. So some really groundbreaking stuff, and also a 2-year partnership with the FA. So I'd worked closely with both of those sporting organisations, and I guess through a lot of the work that I'd done with the FA, I found out about this opportunity, and kind of I'd already built up loads of relationships and projects that we'd both delivered from an FA and a Stonewall perspective. So I always kind of knew that my future would lie outside of the charity sector. It would probably lie within the club or the PL or the FA. And I was incredibly grateful to get the opportunity to kind of do the work from the inside as opposed to influencing from the outside. So it's been a great opportunity so far. And yeah, I've been loving it.
You guys have been around for quite a while. Obviously, as you said, 91 was when it was kind of born. But over the last handful of years has been a new wave of community-based or mission-based clubs. What does that wave of football combined with a social purpose mean going forward?
Well, I think it's important. I think Jay touched on this as well. The role of allies, I think, is very important, because I think when you compare our membership now to 10 years ago, to 10 years before that, you know, we're probably 30-35% maybe of our membership are LGBTQ allies, as opposed to identifying as gay or bisexual. And I think that's really important moving forward, because ultimately, you know, we want to live in a world where it's not about being a gay football team or an LGBT football team. It's about being a football team, you know, for everyone. You know, that kind of thing is great from our point of view. I think we're also seeing different perceptions I touched upon earlier with opposition teams and players. There's far less aggravation from opposition than there was even 4 or 5 years ago. And I think, again, as Jay said, the work that the FA and Stonewall, the charity, have done with the Rainbow Laces campaign, they've provided a great advertisement to the camp, you know, to anti-homophobia, both in society and within football, which is still seen as a very tribalistic sport. You know, I have a season ticket at a Premier League club, and even I've seen a change in the behaviour of fans on a match-by-match basis compared to a few years ago. But this has all been a gradual, you know, the work from the FA, even, you know, the government, society, in the recognition, and we're just a very small cog of that, and we just want to obviously carry on being as useful as we can.
Let's take a break to talk about Smile Generation. They're a network of trusted dentists committed to your health now more than ever. Visit smilegeneration.com for trusted practice for your dental emergencies and dental care. We are committed to your safety and now are offering teledentistry appointments at Smile Generation. .com. Of course, Consolidated Communications, we know that you're an expert on your business, and Consolidated Communications is experts on voice, data networking, and security technologies. Wow, that's a lot of important stuff. They can help propel your business forward, and together they can make great things happen. Visit Consolidated.com to learn more about voice, data networking, and security technologies. Now back to Stonewall FC. What can clubs like us at Sacramento Republic FC, other professional clubs, do to best use their platform to fight against prejudice and homophobia?
You do.
Sorry, tough question, I know.
It's a tough one. You're talking about all forms of prejudice here. I mean, I can speak maybe for, like, over here. We had in the 80s, and even before, we had terrible problems around race in football, and not many people spoke out about it. It was considered part of the game, and if you wanted to get on in football, you had to put up with the racism. I think it's the same with you guys, that, you know, if anybody's been discriminated against because of their color, their sexuality, people need to speak out, and the club needs to speak out. And the club has to say, well, we don't tolerate this. We're all inclusive. We want everybody to come along to watch games. We want people to play. So we are going to challenge anything negative that comes up. And it's taken a while for that to happen over here. And then we, just as we think we've actually got somewhere, it starts going back. So, you know, it's perseverance. I don't think you'll ever get rid of discrimination, but you can always challenge it and keep it under the surface, just keep it down. So, you know, what the FA did over here, did a fantastic job in recent years about challenging racism and now challenging homophobia. It's about challenging. It's about challenging, not letting it go because, oh, that's part of the game, don't worry about it. Either get on or get off. Just challenge.
Yeah, I think, can I just add something to that as well? And I think Ass is absolutely right. It's about challenging. I think particularly when you look at some of the discourse, it's all about power and privilege, right? What platform has the club got to use their power and privilege to combat some of the discrimination that might exist? And as a club, and you've got culture setters everywhere you go in every environment, and it will be no different for the club. So it's all about really being really, really clear on what your club ethos is. What's the environment you want to create? How could you put in things in place to create an inclusive environment, not just for LGBT people, but for all people, all forms of people? And being very, very clear about that. And like Ashley said, challenging sort of discrimination or behaviours whenever you hear it. And also, if you have any reporting mechanisms, what's the reporting process is like? But particularly around challenging, it's not always safe for everybody to challenge. So people who have power and privilege in particular situations, it's going to be more safe for them to challenge than others. So it's all about kind of bringing people on the journey of understanding their power in particular situations and their privilege in particular situations, and giving them the tools and the confidence to be able to use that.
Eric, did you have something to add to that?
I was just going to say, for me, maybe not so much in America, but around the world, football is the number one sport. And, you know, the platform is there, as the two guys have just said, the platform is there. And it's up to everybody at the top, whether it's the players, the clubs, the officials, to make sure that the issue always remains part of the agenda. And there's never any complacency, whether it's to do with racism or homophobia. And to answer your question about what can clubs like yourselves do, even things like this, you know, whether it's the MLS, whether it's the Bundesliga, whether it's Serie A, you know, any kind of visuality or bringing things to attention. The world is at a turning point. We've seen what's been going on around the world the last few weeks. We've seen the protests that have happened. But what we've seen that I think has made them different to perhaps the protests that happened in Brixton back in London in 1981 or back in LA in 1991, the difference for me is the diversity of the protesters. That is something I don't think we have ever seen before.
Didn't have the allies, is it?
No, we didn't have the allies. And that is why I think this is different. And I don't obviously want to turn this into a conversation about, you know, George Floyd, but everything is linked. And seeing London with the Black Lives Matter protesters, but not just seeing every single person protesting is of the same race, it's everyone. And that has been almost, you know, glowing. And obviously Ashley and Jay, you know, can comment on that from their perspective.
It's perfect, because that's exactly where I wanted to head, is talking about how these two causes are intertwined, and what have you guys seen over there in the UK in support of Black Lives Matter as far as the protests. So yeah, please.
Well, what I've seen over here, it's been partially disappointing that we've had to get to this point where we are protesting on such large numbers, but at the same time, it's refreshing. Like what Eric said, it's not just black people are out there protesting. There are Asians, there are white, there are German, French in London who are protesting. It's protesting around the world. Like I said, I'm old enough to remember the civil rights movement, you know, believing that I'm about 1968, Martin Luther King, I was 8 years old. So I knew this was all going on, didn't quite understand it. But then I look at that as much as I can remember it and understand it as an 8 year old, and knowing there's prejudice and people are discriminated against because of the color of their skin, and growing up with someone warned that, you know, whatever you do, you have to be 50 times better because you are black and no one's going to like you because of it. And that's, it feels like there's a massive change going on. It's frightening as well, because with every push, you're going to get some resistance. I mean, we had the situation with the statues over here, and then we had the far right who were out marching last weekend. It is frightening, but you have to face these things head on. Otherwise, you just go back, once the dust settles, you just go back to so-called normality. But I think it's really refreshing, and I'm really hoping that this will be a change, and change for the better. It will be changed, and will be changed for the better. But how we get there, how we get from this point where we are now to having an equal society, it's still up in the air, I think. I don't know if Jay can sort of like want to say something about that, being a younger black man.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with Ash in the sense that it's definitely really refreshing. And particularly if you look at the people who are protesting, who are engaging in the discourse, and who are being part of the resistance and the conversation, they're all young people. So I think it shows the disparity between the outlooks on life and the outlooks on the movement from the younger generation to an older generation. And sometimes our tragedies become really powerful movements. And obviously George Floyd is just one example, but this happens on a weekly basis, and I think it's continued to happen even beyond George Floyd,
in
and
Atlanta.
even as people are still in the streets protesting. So it's a movement and it's a resistance which is not new, and the irony that it's all kicking off during Pride Month, which obviously the Stonewall and Pride started out of the Stonewall riots, which was in fact an act of resistance against police brutality and the ill treatment of LGBT people. So I think you've sort of touched upon the link between the LGBT liberation movement and the Black liberation movement, and I think they're absolutely massively entwined. And a lot of the conversation now, which is another thing which is quite refreshing, is about liberation. I think we're shifting away from the fact that people have become passive for too long, but people are realizing that everybody's responsible for the kind of creating the world that we want to live in. So that's also refreshing. But yeah, I think we're a long way away from being able to kind of celebrate or be complacent. Like I said, there's still massive injustice and inequalities permeating every inch of society. So we need to just harness this and keep momentum. And even though it's Pride Month, I think it's a massive opportunity to kind of reflect on some of the queer Black people, Black trans people who started that movement. So yeah, it's a great chance to celebrate, reflect, and continue to treat Pride as a celebration, but also as a place where we reflect on the resistance that historically we've needed to show.
It's just a very, very weird time, and we're in the middle of a virus that is killing a hell of a lot of people, and disproportionately people, Black and Asian people are dying, and it seems our government have information on that and are keeping it quiet. It's bizarre. I mean, coming from where I come from, my family came to England in the 1950s, mid-50s, and I thought I would never have to face the sort of things that they faced when they came to England. There were literally signs, and I remember seeing one as a small child of a sign on a window letting out rooms, and it did say no blacks, no Irish, and no dogs. I saw one that I can remember. And I thought, you know, we don't see those signs anymore. But the signs, so to speak, are in some people's heads still. They will look at someone of color and they've already got that little sign up that, you know, that person's not going to get this room or not going to get that job. But very difficult to prove. Unfortunately, in some circumstances with racism and homophobia, things that you can't actually prove that is the case unless there's a great big sign there or someone actually says something. I think that's maybe the difference between the United States and Britain is that, you know, we're very good at not saying certain things, whereas the United States is a very big country and there are large pockets of people who are maybe have never met a Black person before will be quite vocal with their views. I'm sure there are places in England. I'm pretty sure my other half is from North Yorkshire, and there are places there where you know you don't see a Black person apart from on TV. And I'm sure they will look at the press or look at TV and see what they see and think, oh, that's what Black people are like. And maybe it's about changing people's perceptions about what people of different colored skin or different cultures are like.
Yeah. I think it's ironic that the UK was the only country to have a counter protest to the Black Lives Matter protests, which was off the back of the heels of the Prime Minister saying that the country isn't racist a week ago. But yeah, it's like Ashley said, it's a very interesting time, almost a very challenging time. So I think Asti made a great point, particularly around how we like racism and homophobia is so much more covert now. So we're dealing with instances of microaggression so regularly, and we kind of palm them off as this bit, oh, it's just a microaggression. It wasn't actually over homophobia or racism, so I'll just ignore it. And if that builds up, and that happens how many different times a day? And I think we kind of, we mistake that for like as if it's not trauma, but But I think we need to be very clear that that is an act of trauma, and that affects all LGBT people and all people of colour, which is why probably you see sort of violent acts of resistance, because people are going through trauma on a daily basis. And if you're not being heard, then you figure out other ways of being heard. So, yeah.
And, you know, to transition away a little bit, obviously we know that that's a massive, massive movement going on right now. And I hope that these continue to have conversations with everybody that includes all different injustices, and hopefully, again, for that one goal of equality for all. So, I mean, hopefully these protests, conversations like these that we are having, can help others who maybe don't understand. And that's kind of what our goal is with some of these podcast episodes that we're doing during Pride Month, that obviously are touching in with Black Lives Matter and those injustices as well. Jay, I want to ask you a couple more questions, but Jay specifically, and I touched on in the pre-interview, you were a part of the Adidas Superstar campaign along the likes of Jonah Hill, Pharrell, Paul Pogba. Incredible. Can you tell us about that experience and a little bit about being named to the football blacklist last year? What has that been like for you?
I forgot about that. Yeah. sometimes, I don't know, sometimes I have to step back and kind of, because I've got a bad memory in general, but sometimes I do step back. And, yeah, that happened. It's been a whirlwind sort of three to five years, to be honest. And I've been very incredibly grateful and privileged of some of the opportunities that I've had, and particularly the Adidas opportunity. Again, like one of the benefits and one of the privileges of playing for a club like Stonewall FC is that it's been able to sort of assisted and sort of given me a voice and being able to share my story. And Adidas, sort of, who have come on board and are really supportive of the club. I think they've really found a real passion of sharing stories and finding out how to influence fears to sharing stories, because it could be quite powerful. And I think they've really looked at doing that in a really authentic way. So being a part of the Adidas Originals campaign was very, very surreal. But most importantly, I was just grateful to be able to kind of use that platform to provide more visibility, as we spoke about earlier. The Football Blacklist was another surreal night. So I'd won. I was named on the ones to watch. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, and then I actually won a Football Blacklist last year. So it was particularly pleasing to be named as like a young ones to watch, and then actually win an actual award. I think it's just there's a lot of parts to that, and that's because, particularly in that space, there aren't many LGBT people of colour who are kind of doing this work, particularly in sport, because it's quite challenging environment to be doing LGBT inclusion. I was very grateful that to be sort of recognised for that. But again, like, I think it's we just need more people to be able to fight that fight, and more people, sort of LGBT people of colour, to be able to share their stories and influence and empower others to be able to be their authentic selves as well.
And Asley, you got your MBE for your work in combating homophobia. We talked about it. We compare it to the Presidential Medal of Honor here in the States. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
The word surreal keeps coming up in this conversation, and it was a very, very surreal, unexpected thing to come up. When the letter came through the letterbox, I thought it was jury service. So I was looking forward to having a few weeks off work, you know, nice meaty case to, you know, sort of like preside over maybe. But then finding out what it was, and it was for services to Stonewall Football Club. I couldn't believe it. I was quite numb by it. It wasn't until going to Buckingham Palace and then the press interest a little bit before and after that made me think, oh my God, this is bigger than me. It's not about me. It's about all those gay sportsmen and women that have sacrificed so much, and all the people outside of the sport who happen to be gay, who are pioneers, and Alan Turing, even going further back, to allow me to go out and spend money going around the world playing football, for crying out loud. And I get an MBE for being part of that, you know, for services to the club. I thought that was surreal. And I thought that award was basically for everybody that sacrificed so much so that we can do what we do as recreation on a weekend or midweek. So yeah, it was nice me going to the palace and picking it up and everything, all the things that go with it. But then it's, I think of all the people that went before, and I try and live up to that by going around to schools and universities and colleges and talking about discrimination to all age ranges and seeing the reaction that comes back from that. And I think I get so much from, well, the teachers and the lecturers turn around and say, well, they got so much from it, they loved it. And I'm not sure if that's correct. I'm wondering who got more out of it. Did I get more out of it, or did they get more out of it? I'm undecided about that.
I think it's obvious that they did, Astley, and let me jump in before, but because that was, from, you know, as a club, to have one of our founding members, to have one of our greatest ever individuals, to be recognized in that way, was just absolutely overwhelming. You know, we've done so much as a club. We've been invited to Downing Street to meet the Prime Minister. We've got the stuff going on now with Adidas, which Jay and some of the more current players are involved with. But, you know, we're talking 10 years, 2010, wasn't it, Astley?
Yes. Yeah, the letter came through 2010, but then with all that happening, my dad and people dying before Christmas, it got pushed to 2011 when I actually went to the palace to pick it up.
Of course. So we're talking 10 years ago, and 10 years in the cycle of any kind of discrimination is a long time. So to get that recognition, and Astley said himself, he goes around the schools, he goes to colleges, he speaks to people as a young black gay footballer who helped found one of the most well-known amateur football clubs probably in the world, who has a unique sense of place in society. And still, every weekend, he will be there if he's needed to help out for the first team off the field, with the second team, playing every Sunday. The man is, you know, honestly, one of the most proudest things in the history of this club was the club being recognized for the MBE, but more importantly was that particular individual being recognized for it. And it was just a wonderful moment.
Thank you, Eric. I'm a bit speechless at the moment. I think, I'll go back to saying, well, it was for everybody. It wasn't just for me. And all I wanted to do was share it with everybody. I wanted everybody to benefit from this thing. It wasn't about me, really. I didn't wake up one morning and say, oh, I'm going to start a gay football club. Let's do it. That's not what happened. It's me being someone looking out for himself, just wanting to enjoy the sport, and then meeting like-minded people who wanted to enjoy the sport. And from there, we went on. And yeah, I stuck around a hell of a long time because I just loved it. That, when I go back to saying, you know, you have to love your sport, I do love football, because I was told at a young age I couldn't play, I'd be too little. And I adopted this sport and loved it. And the people that sacrificed so much for me, the people that I played with in the early days sacrificed so much for me. So I could do so. Yes, I went to the palace and I got it, and I've got it in my wardrobe right now next to my underwear. But it's, we won't go there. But I do recognize it was for everybody. It's for the New York Ramblers, for San Francisco, Martina Navratilova, for Billie Jean King. It's for Alan Turing. It's for Quentin Crisp. It's for Oscar Wilde. It's for Jay. It's for Eric. It's for Doug. It was for everybody. And that's how I saw it. That's how I managed to cope with it as well. I just felt it was immense pressure. But then what brought it back to saying, yeah, you can handle this, because it wasn't just for you. It's for all those people who before you did stuff, just like in the civil rights movement, the Martin Luther Kings, the Rosa Parks, I think they did what they did so that I could decide whether I'm going to sit at the front of the bus or not. or a train. So
and you know, taking back forward 9 years back to the experience at Wembley Stadium, and it wasn't just about, obviously, you know, you're in the stadium, but for me, one of the most incredible moments, I don't know, Jay, I think you were there, I think Ashley, you met us separately, was we met outside the stadium to get the squad together, and then we walked down and you saw the arches lit up, and you saw on the LCD screen Stonewall FC versus Wilberforce Wanderers, and that little walk, which was probably 2 hours before the game, was probably as it was probably as much of the wow moment for me as anything else, walking down as a squad, me leading, you know, we're talking about Ashley's experience, for me leading my team down Wembley Way going into the stadium, and that was just like the biggest wow moment ever. But everything, you know, comes from something else, and that doesn't happen without the MBE for Stonewall and Ashley. That doesn't happen without San Francisco Spikes and New York Ramblers. That doesn't happen without the Stonewall Riots. So everything leads on to something else, and Adidas doesn't happen as is happening now with the link and everything without Wembley. So it's all about continuing to make those steps.
Well, guys, this has been absolutely incredible. I mean, truly, I thank you so much. We thank you so much for jumping on to talk about Stonewall FC, your guys' stories, a little bit of what it's like to be an LGBTQ player. I mean, truly and truly incredible. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for getting in touch. And thank you for wanting to do this, Chris. You know, we don't have people like you wanting to come forward and talk. We just don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, there's a chance of us just stagnating, but you know, there's more interest coming in, and we thank you as well.
And obviously, yeah, keep up all the good work. And if you ever find yourself in the UK, there is a Manchester United ticket for you anytime you want one. The only problem is you'll have to sit next to me. But
that sounds excellent. I would love to do that.
No. You have my word.
You might regret that.
Our thanks to, of course, Stonewall FC, first team captain Jay Limonius, manager Eric Najib, and co-founder Asley Pitter. A couple of incredible stories there, and a little bit about being indomitable. And I kind of like that their story kind of embodies the indomitable spirit. And of course, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to have them on. Incredible. And again, thank you so much to them. Stonewall FC doing incredible work across the pond, as they say. And we will see you next week on The Breakaway. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you have a great day.